Everyone has a story to tell. What's yours? Welcome to the Around the World podcast. I'm your host, Dan Perry. Do you enjoy hearing tales of world adventure? Would you like travel advice from those who know the road well? Maybe you want to embark on a journey of your own, and you just need a bit of motivation to get started. You'll find all of that and more in the Around the World podcast.
My guest for today is Kathy McGowan. Kathy is a really well-traveled woman, but beyond just going to places, she actually likes to live in places, and she's lived in over 50 houses in total. She has a website called travelsthroughmylife.com, and I'll put up a link to that in the show notes. And from her website, you can read a lot of interesting and funny and crazy stories about the stuff that's happened to her over the years. Kathy's a great conversationalist, and I really enjoyed talking to her. So let's jump right into it and listen to my conversation with Kathy McGowan.
Tell me about your mummified cat.
Well, I live in Bulgaria, and we have this barn, a really big barn. And when we first arrived there, it was full of corn, like really full of old corn stalks. And over the time, over the next couple of years, these corn stalks got used for various things. And then one day, underneath a pile of corn stalks, some volunteers discovered a mummified cat. And I have to say, to be honest, it looks pretty grotesque.
Yeah?
But I really, really like this cat. Everybody I know hates it. Lots of people are scared of it. You can see pictures of it on the website.
On your website?
Uh-huh.
Cool. I'll put up a link for everybody to look at.
All right, great. And sometimes, one time I painted the cat's teeth with red sparkly nail varnish, so it looks kind of, well, even more grotesque, really.
So what, you took it out from under the corn and brought it inside or something?
Well, I guess what had happened was this cat had just died underneath this corn. Maybe, from what I can understand, the old people who lived in the house, it must have been 20-odd years since they'd ever done anything in this barn. So this would have been there for at least 20 years. So this cat must have just gone in there and died. It didn't seem to have any injuries or anything, you know. Huh. Animals just die sometimes.
Sure.
And nothing ever ate it. No rats ever got in, and it just gradually dried out.
It just got desiccated and didn't decompose?
No.
Huh.
So it's flat. It's got leathery skin, and it's flat.
Yeah.
But its face is there with this really gross socket with half an eye kind of hanging out of it. And its mouth's open, and its teeth are there, and its claws. And for me, this cat now has a new life. It's been resurrected.
Yeah.
And my daughter and I lived in the same house for a while, and every time I leave, she takes the mummified cat down off the wall. But when
she
I'm
doesn't
there,
like it?
No, she hates it.
Huh.
And she said it frightens the guests and scares kids and stuff like that, which I think is just...
Well, you should get her to take care of it and feed it while you're gone. And like,
well,
you know,
I kind of said that, but she said no. So, yeah, it's just generally called the mummified cat. And
it doesn't have a name?
No, I think that's a pretty good name, actually.
The mummified cat.
We have 10 other cats in the house, but... No, the mummified cat is my special friend.
10 living cats and one mummified. Yeah, you didn't mention that last night.
No, it was just when you said that about, we were talking about the mic thing here and talking about that hairy thing on top of the mic.
It's interesting. Yeah, if you put, I think they actually call it a dead, or a cat tail.
Oh, really?
If you put a cat tail over a microphone, it looks like a big piece of fur that blocks out the wind noise. The
right, yeah.
It's like
pretty annoying noise.
Right, and that helps. And it doesn't take much of a breeze to generate that noise.
No, it doesn't. So. Right. Mm.
Cats. It's interesting how we kind of have a few expressions related to cats and dead cats. Like the stock market. If the stock market's crashing, and then one day it just goes up a little bit, they call that a dead cat bounce.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Because it's probably going to drop again, is the theory. And even if you drop a dead cat from really high up, it'll still bounce a little bit.
Okay, that's a bit
a little gruesome.
Yeah, it is. It is a bit.
But that's kind of the parlance of the stock market guys.
I guess for me, I've always lived with cats, and this one just seemed like could do with a new life.
For sure, huh?
I just had. I've been in China for the last 3 years, and one of the first things that I did when I got here was acquire 2 cats.
Oh yeah.
Because I kind of knew at the time that I was going to stay here for more than a year, and then I quickly got these 2 cats. And I always knew that my relationship with these cats was going to have to end. Normally when I move, I take my cats with me, but this was a little bit different.
Yeah, it's pretty hard to do that, huh? Quarantine and everything?
No, you don't have to have quarantine these days. You just get microchips and things.
Oh, okay.
Well, except if you go to a place like Britain, that's different, but I don't live in Britain. Uh-huh. I did toy with the idea of taking my cats back to Bulgaria. I thought about it for about 2 days and then realised this was ridiculously expensive and just not going to work. Uh-huh. So my cats have now gone to live in a Buddhist temple.
Huh, okay. Were these cats that, were they just inside your apartment all the time?
No, I live in a ground floor apartment, so I just left a window open all the time, so they just came in and out.
Yeah, I find a lot of people's relationships with cats here seem to be similar to that, where, like here we're in this open courtyard, and it's kind of hard for humans to get in, but for cats it's super easy. They just jump on the roof and come in.
Yeah.
Cats will just come over and meow a little bit, and people feed them, and then that's their cat. And
that's true, yeah. Our cats choose to live with you.
Yeah, otherwise they're rather feral. They just go out and do their thing and come back for food.
I don't know about being feral. They're choosy.
Maybe feral's not the right word.
We have cats who spend some time in other houses, and then when they get sick of that, they come back to us. Mm. That's being choosy.
Yeah. So I met you like a couple days ago now, and every time we bring up a new part of the world, it seems like you've lived there.
Well, I'm a lot older than you.
Yeah.
Maybe that's a good place to start, because I was thinking about it last night, because I would say that my occupation in life is being a traveller.
Okay.
And, or a nomad, but more a traveller, more like. And I started doing that when I was like 18.
Yeah.
And that's a long time ago. That was before the internet or anything like that. So.
For sure. Is that in the 60s or 70s?
70s, 1970-ish, I think, or 71, 70. Okay. So I thought maybe I should tell you about how I started.
Yeah, go for it. I'd love to hear it. Where'd you grow up, first of all?
Oh, Newcastle, in the northeast of England.
Okay.
And after high school, I really had just probably one of the most boring jobs in the world.
What was that?
Oh, just in this terrible office. It's complicated what we were doing. It's got to do with the National Health Service, which is, you're an American, so it's too complicated to explain what all about.
My
that.
American brain could never comprehend
the National
Health Service in England.
Anyway, it was a very, very boring job. And outside of the window of this office, we were on like the third floor, and outside of the window was the main north-south route in England, the A1, going from London to Edinburgh.
Okay.
Crossing the bridge, the Tyne Bridge. Newcastle sits on a big long river called the River Tyne, and there's this beautiful big bridge that Sydney Harbour Bridge was copied off. It looks exactly the same.
Is that right?
So right outside of our window, there was this constant line of traffic going somewhere, north or south, and the river, and traffic on the river. And in the distance, I could see the sea. And I used to look at this window and think, where's everybody going? Everybody's going somewhere, and I'm stuck here. And sure. I just thought, oh. One of my favourite phrases in life is, oh, fuck this for a carry-on. I'm not doing this anymore. So I'm going to go somewhere else. I'm going to do something.
Yeah.
But this was before the internet. So it was actually hard to know what to do. You know, how do you go abroad? How do you do anything?
Right.
Where's the jobs? How can you do anything like this? And actually, it was such a long time ago that to go outside of Britain to go into Europe, I needed a smallpox vaccination.
Is that right? Huh.
Yeah. Now, that's only in the 70s, but isn't that interesting that you would never think of that?
No. Smallpox. No, kids don't even get vaccinated for it anymore. It's completely wiped out, as far as I know.
Almost. There's pockets of it in parts of the world.
Is that right?
Very small pockets. But so the only people I could think of that actually did things abroad was airlines. Mm-hmm. And I didn't, I didn't really want to walk around dressed neatly and serving people tea all day, you know, and talking in a very posh voice.
Not your thing, huh?
Not really. I don't think I would have got in as well, because I come from Newcastle and we have a very strong dialect. Okay. I don't speak posh English. So I thought, oh, the government, right? The government has embassies everywhere in Europe, that'll do. So I wrote letters to half a dozen British embassies in Europe just saying, can I have a job? Because I didn't know how the system works, you know?
Again, before the internet, like, if everyone you know is just kind of in your area and they're all kind of not travelers, they're all kind of doing their thing, like,
Nobody I knew did anything like this at all, ever.
Right.
And nobody that my friends knew or anything. So I wrote letters to about half a dozen embassies just at random, and two of them responded to me. Lisbon and Copenhagen, and they both offered me jobs.
Oh, kind of cool.
Not. I can't remember what the job was in Lisbon, but the one in Copenhagen was working in the kitchen at the ambassador's residence. Huh. Now, on reflection, if I had gone to Lisbon, well, who knows where my life would have gone then? I would have certainly experienced warmth. For the first time in my life, warm summer air.
So this is one of those turning points for you.
Definitely, yeah, yes. Yeah. When I think back to it, you know, there are forks in the road of life. Yeah. And I went one way or the other. But at the time, in the 70s, Copenhagen was the coolest city in Europe. Mm. Much more so than what Amsterdam is now. It was all about freedom, love, sex, drugs, everything. Huh. Copenhagen was the place in Europe.
Mm. So I didn't know that.
I thought, it's not now, it's kind of different
now. They've tightened up a little bit?
No, they've gone very smug and conservative. But anyway, that's I accepted it and I said, right, okay, I'll take this job. And then all my friends were just gobsmacked. Everybody couldn't believe it, didn't really understand what I was doing or anything. And so I set off on my first journey. Most of my friends now know that when they're friends with me, what I do always is say goodbye. I'm always leaving. But that very first time, all my friends came and stood at the station at Newcastle to wave me off, and it was like, oh my God, there's hundreds of, not hundreds, but there was about 15 or 20 people there all waving me off.
Like a celebrity.
Kind of. Huh. As time went on, that number got less and less, and then people just said, oh, goodbye.
Yeah, they're used to it.
So yeah, that was my first thing. I went to work, and it was also the poshest job I ever had. Working at the ambassador's residence in the kitchen. It was probably something that began to politicize me as well, because for the first time I really looked at, I was really confronted by waste, in my opinion, how money is spent.
Oh, government waste, you mean?
Yeah. And as a taxpayer, I suddenly, you know, kind of realized, hang on a minute, I'm a British taxpayer, I'm paying for this.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
What a waste.
Yeah.
Look at all this stuff that's going on here.
Right.
So that was the first time really in that kitchen that I think I started to have any real political views about the world.
Huh. It's funny you say that, because I was just in the British Embassy recently in Beijing, and looking at, I went to a presentation on these air filters that are, they do the job, but they're really cheap.
Right.
And the regular ones, expensive ones, they literally cost like 20 times more. And the British government provides these for all their employees, for all their British employees, but not for their Chinese employees.
Huh.
And it's like, how hard would it be to convince them to save 95% of their budget on these air filters? Because they're spending thousands of dollars on each one. How about you cut that down to about $35
and give one to everyone.
And just give one to everyone. And but ooh, that's like a mountain to climb with the bureaucracy, I think.
Yeah, I'd say so, yeah. Yeah.
And then you'd save taxpayer dollars too, but I guess even today governments don't quite go that way.
I know.
Hmm.
So anyway,
go on. Yeah.
I had a great time in Copenhagen, lived there for a year. It was just it was kind of everything I thought it was going to be from the point of view of being a very, well, I didn't realise how naive and enclosed my life had been before that, how naive I was. So it kind of really opened my eyes to a lot of stuff. But there weren't, that was in the days really before travellers. Kind of, it was pre-hippie time. So there wasn't really a lot of actual travellers going around at the time. And actually, one of the things I've come to know is that travellers don't go to Scandinavia.
Just too expensive? Or?
Yeah, and it's not kind of on the way from anywhere to anywhere, and it's often cold.
It's out of the way.
Because I met some other expats there, particularly I met this New Zealand woman, and her and I spent some of the time over the next few years together. But directly after we both, she was a nanny in Copenhagen. And directly after that, her and I went travelling and hitching in Scandinavia. So we went north through Sweden and Norway, right up to the North Cape, and then down through Finland and back across Sweden. And in all the years since, I have never met anybody who's done that trip.
Really?
I just don't meet people who travel in the north of Scandinavia. And yes, it's expensive, but it's brilliant.
Oh, that's got me thinking. Next year, or this later this year now, my wife and I are going to take some time off to travel. And we have some friends who we knew from Beijing, but the guy is Finnish. And he lives, I forget the name of the town now, but it's in the north of Finland, very far north. It's a bit of a touristy town for Finns to go. But
Oulu or Rovaniemi, somewhere like that maybe.
I don't think it's either of those, but maybe somewhere near there. And we were kind of thinking of, it's way out of the way.
You definitely should go.
We want to go to Moscow and get the train across the Trans-Siberian. But maybe before that, we could go to Finland. Somehow make it work.
If you ever had the opportunity to go north through Norway, because we took a, I don't know if it's still there. If it's there, it's a hidden secret. But there's a boat bus that local people use that goes in and out of every fjord and stops about 10 times a day. Because in the north of Norway, there's no roads.
Okay.
It's a really long, narrow country, and it's just got mountains that go down to the sea. That's it. There's no roads. So everybody goes by sea in and out of these fjords. And we just kind of hitched our way up as far as we could in Norway, and then we found this boat. And my friend and I, we got on this boat and managed to blag our way into the first class lounge for the first couple of days, because these American grannies took pity on us. But then we got chucked out of that. But it didn't matter. It was all right. We just had this cabin, and this boat went in and out of every fjord.
Yeah.
It was absolutely amazing. It was glorious. Blue skies and seagulls and fjords and waterfalls, and just beautiful. And then we went round the North Cape, across the top of Norway, and we got off this boat in the very, very north of Finland, foolishly thinking that we were going to hitch down through Finland. And when we got off this boat, there was like two tin shacks and a couple of lap guys with sleighs with reindeer and all the full gear on, which looked amazing, and this rickety old bus. And we kind of realised, okay, we have to get on this bus. There's no other option.
Yeah.
There's no way to hitch. So we ended up on this a few bus rides down through Finland. And just, if you have the opportunity, you should try to do that. It's such an amazing trip.
Cool, maybe we'll work it in. But when I try to remember like the order of those countries, Finland and Sweden and Norway, what I always remember is NSF, Norway, Sweden, Finland. But NSF also means not sufficient funds.
Oh, does it?
In banking.
So, that's an American term.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
I'm like, and I just not sufficient funds.
They are expensive.
Yeah.
But actually, I want to tell you about one of the loveliest meals that I ever had, which was in a hostel in Finland. Because after my friend and I got off of this bus, we had no option but to stay on buses for the next kind of, I don't know, 20 hours or something. Because there was no options, there was no roads or anything. We got off this bus and said, we have to get on this one, and we didn't We were going south, but we didn't really know where we were going. And eventually we got off this bus. It was also the midnight sun, right?
Yeah.
Complete daylight. Yeah. Totally disorientating. Really weird.
Must be.
Are those kids going to school or coming home? Huh. I don't know. Anyway, we eventually got off the bus at this hostel, which was in the middle of nowhere. Little wooden huts in a forest. And we were really, really tired. And this lovely woman showed us into this nice room and everything, and we had a sleep. And when we got up, we realised we didn't have any Finnish money. So we went and spoke to this woman, who spoke a very little bit of English. And it's like, well, she said, there's no way here. You'll have to, and it's Friday.
Yeah.
You'll have to wait till Monday to go to the bank.
So
we were, oh, God, okay, we're starving.
Right.
What do we do? So we were sitting there, the two of us, looking out the window at this gorgeous scenery and thinking, we're really, really hungry. And there's nowhere here. We're in the middle of a forest. What are we going to do? And then this woman came out of her kitchen and invited us to have dinner with her and her family.
Okay.
And I suddenly remember this as being one of the loveliest meals ever. It made me think of the Waltons. Huh. You know the Waltons?
Everything I know of them, yeah.
Really? Did you not grow up watching the Waltons?
No, that's a little before my time.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, wooden table. Everything in the house was like wooden and homemade. All of the food was homemade beer.
Yeah.
Loads of people sitting around the table and just this gorgeous, fabulous meal and this lovely food and this woman's great generosity. So she fed us over the whole of this weekend.
Got saved.
Yeah. And then she took us, her son took us to the bank on Monday and we changed some money or whatever we did in those days.
Yeah, however it
works. I can't remember that
before ATMs.
But I always remember that woman's kindness and generosity and the fantastic food.
Sounds like you learned a couple of important lessons there. Like
to share and pass it on.
Yeah, yeah. The generosity thing and just having enough money.
Well, to have the right money in the right place.
Yeah.
Her sons took us out for a trip, a ride one afternoon, and I didn't know where we were going. I kind of find it useful to say yes when people ask me to do things and I don't know what it is. You know, I usually say yes.
It's a good attitude.
It's usually worked.
Yeah.
So this day we ended up, we drove off with these two guys in their van, and then we stopped in the middle of a forest, in the middle of literally nowhere, and they got out these two rifles. And a couple of, I thought, are we going to go hunting or something here? and then they brought out two crates of beer bottles. So they put these bottles up on an old tree.
Yeah.
And I remember standing there with this rifle and thinking, I don't really know where I am. I'm in the middle of nowhere holding a rifle with two guys who don't speak English. I've got no idea who they are. Nobody in the world knows where I am.
Yeah, that's scary.
No, it wasn't. It was actually really, it was quite good fun.
Ah.
I thought, and now I'm doing target practice with the rifle and some Carlsberg beer bottles. Yeah, that works.
Well, I guess since they handed you a rifle.
Oh, yeah, they handed me the rifle. Yeah, that,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah. If it was just them with the rifles, ooh.
I have to be honest and say, perhaps had I been in America, I might have thought about
then
it
maybe
differently.
It's different.
But this was in the 70s in the north of Finland, and I wasn't scared at all.
Yeah. Well, I think if you're in a rural part of America, it might be much the same too. Like hunting's just so normal and target practice, whatever.
I suppose, yeah.
Yeah.
So that was a long time ago, and that was the beginning of travel, and I never really stopped since then.
Yeah, so where'd you go next? Do you remember?
I travelled a bit in around the UK. I lived in Scotland. I lived in different places. I do usually remember where I did. Actually, the next main place that I went, I lived in India.
Okay.
I did some travelling around Europe, just visiting friends, and I went to the World Cup in Germany and stayed for a while. That was kind of interesting because I hung out with the British Army in Germany. That was an interesting experience.
Yeah.
Some relatives of mine were teachers with the Army, really, really weird existence. Very weird. But
so they were just there for the World Cup? Just
no,
to watch
no.
It?
They were living there, and I went to the World Cup, and I stayed with them. And then, so that was my, it was an experience of living with the different, a very, very different kind of expat community.
Yeah, yeah. I've run into a few of them, like American soldiers who are off duty here and there. But yeah, different lifestyle for sure.
It really is.
Different attitude.
It's not travelers, and it's not, they're not there for interest or necessarily enjoyment. They're just there because they have to be.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm. And get a few days off, and what do you do?
Yeah, I don't know, but yes, I had kind of forgotten about that. That was an interesting experience. Hmm. But then I was around Britain for a long time, different places, and being a hippie.
Yeah.
And then I went to live in the southwest of Scotland, which is a very alternative, big hippie community.
Really?
Huh. Yeah. Huh. Very wet. Dreich, great Scottish word.
What's that mean?
Grey, wet, miserable, damp, windy, dreich.
It's like, this is the one you taught us before then.
Yeah, actually, if you listen, it's an onomatopoeic word, I think. It sounds dreich.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. It sounds like a dreary word.
But everybody I knew was going off to India and doing stuff like that. So I was married at the time to a Scottish guy, a baker. Mm. And we had a child, we had a daughter. And then we just decided to go to India.
All of you? The three of you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It started off because I didn't like. I had a washing machine that I hated.
And that's what drove you to India?
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah. My partner,
yeah, that'll do it.
My partner was a baker, and every day I had to wash his white things, you know, because he worked all night at the bakery and made great stuff. And I used to stand at this washing machine looking at this fantastic view and the mountains and hills beyond, and I thought, again, I just thought, oh, fuck this, very carry on, I'm not doing this.
So time to move.
Yeah, so Davey woke up one day, and I said to him, right, we'll have to move.
Yeah.
Let's go somewhere different, let's do something different. So he said, oh, okay, where shall we go? I said, I don't know. So we sat one night with a big bag of grass and an atlas. And right, where shall we go?
Yeah. Any darts involved?
What?
Darts? Like throw a dart at it?
No. First of all, we went by the process of elimination. Where do we not want to go?
Yeah.
So I didn't want to go and live in a Muslim country. I didn't want to go and live in America. I didn't really fancy South America at that point. Africa seemed a bit wild because my daughter was like 18 months or something.
Okay.
Didn't want to go to Australia because there's too many spiders. Couldn't go to a communist country. Right? This is pre
Iron Curtain
job. So, kind of when you do all of those things,
you've taken away a lot of places.
You take away a lot, and we ended up with a choice between St. Lucia in the Caribbean or India.
Huh. And India wasn't too wild for you.
Oh no,
Africa was. But.
Oh, India isn't wild. No, not at all. And also, Davey had been to India on the hippie trail earlier.
All right.
And I'm English, so I have an affinity with India from the Raj. You know, like India is not a strange place.
Okay.
Not at all. And most people in India speak English.
Yeah, that's so nice.
Yeah. It's a different kind of English. But so, yeah, we decided to go to India.
Where did you go then?
Well, we didn't really have a plan, except that the plan was to stay there for about 5 years or something.
That's a plan.
but between deciding to go and going, I became pregnant.
Oh.
So that was interesting. We didn't tell anybody.
So you were pregnant and you flew there?
Yeah.
So anyway.
Yeah, we didn't tell anybody because everybody was like, everybody was freaking out. But, oh, you're taking that little girl to India. Oh, so I didn't tell anybody that I was pregnant. And we didn't kind of really have a plan, except that I wanted to see Shimla, which is when India was part of the British Empire. I can just imagine at some point some pompous diplomat in Delhi saying, go and build me a summer capital somewhere up in the hills.
Sure.
Because Delhi's an unbelievably horrible place to live in the monsoon and pre-monsoon. So they did, Shimla was the summer capital of the British Raj.
Huh. What state is that in?
Himachal Pradesh.
Oh, yeah, yeah, okay. I was there earlier this year.
Ah, you didn't go to Shimla?
Shimla, no. I spent most of my time around Manali.
Ah, okay, yeah, hippie bit.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Shimla's a few valleys further over to the east.
Okay.
And it's just one of the most bizarre, remarkable places you could ever imagine.
Huh. Well, I think we're going to go back, so I'll put that on the list.
Oh, you definitely should, yeah.
Spend more. I only spent like a month there, so we'll want to spend a long time there.
It's a really bizarre place because it's built up. There's a ridge. There's a ridge that goes between two kind of mountain peaks.
Okay.
And on the top of this ridge, there's a road. And this is called the Mall. And on the north side of this road is a little wall. And if you look over this wall, first of all, there's a precipitous drop. And then if you look beyond, you can just see the snowy peaks of the Himalayas going on and on and on. Then you turn around, the Himalayas to the back of you, and you turn around and in front of you is a row of old houses and shops that look like they could have come out of 1950s Britain.
Huh.
And on your left, if you turn and look to your left, you'll see an English church and a mock Tudor style building. That's that road. It winds around the hills to the left to the what was it called? The vice? I don't know. I forgot the name of the title of the person who rules India at the time.
The vice royalty? Was that what you're going
to
say?
No, the it'll come to me.
Whatever. Yeah.
Lord Mountbatten was one of them. Anyway, the head of India at the time in the Raj. So they had a palace around there, and this is all along the top. Then if you go down behind that, there's the bazaar. And it is the most amazing place.
Yeah.
You can only go up it by foot. Uh-huh. And in some places, it's so steep you can't put your foot on the ground.
Oh. It's like along a cliff?
It goes zigzag.
Oh, like switchbacks all the way down?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. And you have to walk up to the top, so there's no vehicles in it.
No. Huh. Well, if you took a vehicle, it goes right along somewhere outside and back around different ways to get to the top of the mall.
Okay.
But no, you have to walk up it, and the train station and everything's at the bottom.
Huh.
It's really one of the most bizarre places, and it's pretty high up.
It's a bizarre bazaar.
Yeah, it is. Yes, yeah.
Huh. Uh-huh. I remember going to this really cool like market in Bolivia. Up in the what's it called, the Cordillera Waiwash, which is like a pretty remote mountain region,
right.
And like once a week at like sunrise or dawn is this bazaar where it's like on the Altiplano, so it's probably over 4,000 meters, and all these guys just selling random things, and it's just super well preserved. There's no tourists. Yeah, my friend bought a poncho off a guy's back. He's like, and I was like, dude, why are you you're gonna make that guy freeze? Cause it's super cold that early in the morning, up at 4,000 meters.
Yeah.
Wow, those kind of markets are really interesting to me.
I love markets. Yeah. Where we're sitting right now in Shanxi, I'm really sorry that I foolishly missed the market.
Yeah.
But anyway, I just have to let that go.
There's a Friday market here for those who don't know.
I know.
Yeah, you'll catch a different one.
I will.
This part of China has a lot of minorities. Mm. There's, I think 56 ethnic groups in China that are recognized, and Han is the majority, and that's Chinese people. Mm. Like almost everybody's Han.
Yes.
But then there's 55, I'm pretty sure it's 55, minorities. And
they're mostly in this area.
Yeah, a good deal of them are. So a lot of them come down from their farms up in the hills to sell their stuff once a week on Fridays. Yeah, but yeah, you'll catch the next one.
I will.
Yeah,
I will. Although I won't be back in China.
No.
I don't really do going back.
Yeah, well,
I've been here 3 years, and that's
it's a long time.
It's a long time, yeah. And yeah, I there's too many other things to see to ever go back.
Yeah, it's a big world. And that, I think that's a good attitude. I've met so many people who travel like fast, including me sometimes. And it's like you almost have to go back to see it because you didn't see it the first time.
Yeah, that's true. I know I've met people. Actually, that's a reason why I don't often stay in hostels, because I get frustrated by the people who are in hostels who say, I've done this and I've done that and I've been here. And actually what they've done is they've just skimmed along the surface of something.
Right.
And they've done it really quickly.
Right.
And they've only seen just, I don't know, they rarely ever go into people's houses.
Yeah.
And to me, that's the big difference. When I travel, I like to go into people's houses.
Yeah, I like couch surfing.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Although I found I can't do it all the time. It's like the lack of privacy kind of gets to me eventually, and sometimes I just want my own space, just to chill.
Yeah, it all depends, really.
But it's such a great way to meet like local people.
Yeah, really, it really is.
Or in my case, like I host people sometimes in Beijing, and I'm obviously not Chinese, but I've lived in Beijing for a few years, so I know a lot of the like cool spots that you wouldn't find in guidebooks. That I can take people to. Yeah, it's such a great concept.
It is. Yeah. I've stayed with people in so many different places. Mm. I did a slow journey through Russia last year.
Oh, yeah?
From China back to Bulgaria by train and boat.
Okay. Through Mongolia?
Mongolia, Russia, down to Astrakhan and back up, and then Ukraine, Moldova, Romania. And I mostly stayed with couch surfers.
Awesome.
It was really interesting, especially I think I had the best experience in Astrakhan.
Hey, what is Astrakhan?
It's at the mouth of the Volga. Because I just tell you that I was so pissed off with the Russian embassy and the hassles that I had getting the Russian visa that I decided I needed to spend the entire 30 days on my visa in Russia. I wasn't going to waste a day of it. So as well as the train journey, I was looking at the map one day, and it's a dangerous thing for me to look at a map.
Because you gotta go.
Well, I usually look at corners and extreme places. And first of all, I was looking at, I've forgotten the name of it now, a town on the very north Arctic coast of Russia. And I was thinking about that, and then I thought, I've been over the Arctic Circle. I'm not doing that again anyway. It'll be cold. Mm. So then I was looking on the other side of the map and I saw the Volga and I thought, big river. Mm. And then I just did a little bit of checking up and realized that it's a really popular tourist thing in Russia. People take cruises down the Volga.
Okay.
So I booked myself a little cruise. I got off the Trans-Siberian in Moscow and went on a 9-day cruise down the Volga.
Wow.
Which was amazing.
Yeah.
Although I have to be honest and say, after a couple of days, I was speaking to my daughter on Skype, and she sort of laughed at me. And I said, "This cruise is really weird." And she said, "I was waiting for you to think about that, Mom, because it's a cruise, and you don't do cruises, and it's a group thing." I have a table and I sit with the same people for breakfast every day. And there's group activities go on in this boat.
Oh, when you first said cruise, I didn't picture a luxurious cruise, like a giant ship.
Big.
Oh, I pictured some like small thing. Okay.
No, there's no small thing.
Not because of the word. You used the right word, but just because of you. I just didn't picture you doing something like that.
Well, that's why my daughter was laughing about this. But it was at the time I was so angry about my visa and the hassle that I was having. And I thought, right, I'm going to do this. And 9 days. And the price wasn't too bad. I thought, I treat myself. But it was all right. But I think I was very challenging for a lot of people on this boat. I was the only foreigner on the boat. And it was half of the rest of the group were retired Russians who were out, you know, for their summer cruise down the Volga.
Yeah.
A really interesting thing I discovered about Russians. They don't make eye contact.
Oh, really?
The opposite example to me would be living in Ireland. Because if you walk past anybody in Ireland, you say hello to them.
Yeah.
You nod. Huh. You have a head twitch like this. You nod your head and say hi.
Oh.
Or you put your finger up if you're driving a car. You always acknowledge somebody when you pass them in Ireland. Doesn't matter who they are or where you are. And you kind of do in Bulgaria as well. Like, I live in a small town. I live in a village. You always greet people.
Yeah, where I'm from too. Uh-huh. It's a smaller city, and
smile or something. Yeah, something. It doesn't have to be a greeting.
Especially for me, like northern Wisconsin is pretty rural, and yeah, you always do the finger thing when you're driving.
Yeah.
You just kind of like flick your fingers off and say hi to anybody passing you. Always.
Not in Russia.
No?
The first town that I spent a few days in, Irkutsk. Nice place. Okay. Lovely wooden houses and stuff like that. Really picturesque. Great market. But people, not a lot of people, you know, so there's people walking about the streets, and I would look at them and smile, and they would freeze and stiffly turn their head away or not give me eye contact. And I thought, oh, this is interesting. Yeah. So I went out of my way to do it then. I really made eye contact with people and smiled, and they were totally confused.
Huh.
So by the time I got on this boat, I thought, oh, this is fun.
Hey, you got to have something to do on this 9-day cruise.
So I started just saying hello to people, you know. Yeah. People on the boat, I would nod to them and smile and say hello.
Yeah.
And it was astonishing. I mean, an Irish person would have stopped immediately and I would have known their life story in half a minute, you know, no problem. Actually, would have played the Irish game, but I'll come back to that in a minute. But that was a really fun, challenging thing on the boat. Because just by smiling, people were they kind of stiffened.
I've had a few people tell me that Russians, there's that wall, and it's really hard to break through. But once you get through it and you kind of get to know somebody, they're like the most friendly, open people you can find.
I found that too, yeah. Okay. If you actually just start speaking to them, really.
That's all it takes,
just get a conversation going.
Yeah.
And I stayed with some people, some Russians, couch surfing, and they were brilliant, lovely people. But it's just this, and I asked them about this eye contact on the street, and they said, oh no, we don't do that. No. Yeah. We think if somebody's going to look at you like that, that they want something, and they're going to attack you or something.
Okay.
That was really funny.
I've experienced that in Korea a bit. Like, there's this thing, they don't look you in the eye there. They just like look down.
Okay.
It's like really disrespectful to,
okay.
Or it could mean you're like submitting.
Right.
So there's this problem with some of the teachers in Beijing that I know. Like, if they're disciplining a Korean kid, they have to know the kid's not going to look up. The kid's going to look down. And so it's like this cultural thing. Like, if a Westerner is like, hey, you can't do that. Hey, look at me. Look at me. Look up at me. And the kid's like submitting, like looking down.
Yes,
like, yes, I admit I did it wrong.
It's so interesting, the background for all these actions and things.
For sure. That can be totally different than what we're used to. Huh. Well, what did you say, the Russian game?
The Irish game.
Irish game, that's what it was. What's that?
Well, if you meet an Irish person and you have some connection, if you've lived in Ireland, or if two Irish people meet, or an Irish person and somebody who's lived in Ireland, the first thing they will do is establish a connection, and there will be one. There's only 3 million people live in Ireland, and 1 million of them are Dubs and live in Dublin. So you will have a connection.
So it's like the Kevin Bacon thing, the 6 degrees, except it's more like, you know, 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon? Yeah, so it's more like 2 degrees.
It could be. And this has happened, and it's a fact. I have met Irish people all over the world, and when I tell them that I spent a lot of years living in Ireland, then immediately we focus on this. And there will always be a connection.
Wow.
I tell you one of the funniest things. I lived in the border regions of the island of Ireland during the times of the Good Friday Agreement and major political hassles. So there was a lot of army presence and things going on and road checks and, you know, stuff like that. And one day I was driving through County Monaghan, which is in the Republic, and there was an army checkpoint. This is a Garda Síochána, Irish Republican checkpoint, not the British Army.
Yeah.
So I pulled up, and this guy walks over with a pair of old, you know, raggy old dungarees on. I never quite figured that bit out about the Irish Army. With a machine gun slung over his shoulder. So he came over to the car and he said, "Oh, hiya, how are you doing?" I said, said, oh, I'm grand, you know, grand. He says, and asked me where I was going.
Yeah.
And I said, I'm going to County Leitrim. He said, oh, really? Now, what part of Leitrim are you going to? And I told him, I said, no, just outside of Mohill. Really now, which townland would that be? So I told him. He said, oh, no, who is it? And I said, I rent a house there. And he said, really, who is it that you rent a house from? And he wasn't, like, interrogating me.
Is, oh, okay.
Because I told him, and he said, sure, I know his brother. I know his brother, Sean. Now, we went fishing together. And how is his wife? And we're standing there, like, him with a machine gun, leaning in the car, me and him, having this conversation about my landlord, who he knew. There was a great big traffic jam behind us going over the border, which who were oblivious to. And we just had this great chat about this place and this area and the fact that, and, you know, he told me his name, and he said, now, when you go back there now, tell Sean that I was asking after him and all this kind of stuff. So immediately there was a connection.
Huh.
So that's the Irish game.
That's it, huh? He's playing the Irish game. I mean, I've had that, like, driving into Canada. I get that. But it's not a game. They're like, they really want to know that I'm visiting someone or what I'm up to. And,
right.
Yeah, it's more of an interrogation.
Well, actually, when you go north of the border into Northern Ireland, it has a completely different perspective.
Oh, really?
Really, really different. It's the same, similar idea, but... Hmm. But let's not talk about Northern Ireland.
Yeah,
okay. That's way too depressing on a day like this.
Yeah, it's beautiful here, just blue skies.
It is.
Nice and
it
warm.
For me, it's a happy few days end into my time in China because there's no pollution here, blue skies.
And yeah, and for a Chinese town, it's super quiet.
It is. And lovely old buildings and nice people and good food.
Yeah, I'm sure there's all kinds of noises happening everywhere in the background here, but... You know, it's a lot less than you normally have in China.
Yeah, it is.
Hmm. So you kind of told me about a bit about India, but you said you wanted to live there for 5 years.
That was the plan, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, you didn't end up staying that long?
No. One of the reasons that we decided to go there was, at the time, with a British passport, I could stay in India for 52 years.
52 years?
Yeah.
With no application or anything?
No, nothing. No, 52 years. Huh. And while we were there, they changed it from 52 years to 3 months.
That's a bit of a difference.
Somewhat, yes.
Yeah.
It was in the 70s, and the number one thing that happened was Mrs. Gandhi, Indira Gandhi, was shot.
Yeah.
And there was a Sikh uprising, and I think the government... saw this as an opportunity to tie up a big immigration loophole.
Okay. That's a big one. 52 years.
Yeah, most of the expat Sikh community were in Britain or Canada, and they were seen to be financing this insertion, for want of a better word.
Yeah, is that right?
So yeah, we were living halfway up a mountainside in the middle of nowhere, and somebody came and told us one day, hey, you've only got a 3-month visa now.
Wow. And it expired 3 months ago.
Well, kind of. But we had done what you're supposed to do in those places and suck up to the local people, local people. So we got a 3-month visa, and we got a 6-month extension. But we were kind of farmers, you know. We were farmers. We built a house, and we actually, I lie. We didn't build a house. My partner built a house. I sat and watched because I was pregnant.
Okay.
But there was no security in staying there suddenly. You know, there was no way. Before, with a 52-year visa, you could just build a house and you know you're going to stay there and see your crops come up. But suddenly, actually, it was really, really sad because this was, you know, the main hippie time in India in the early 70s. No, 80s. I mean, this was in the early 80s. So there had been hippies living and making their lives in India for the past 10 years.
Yeah.
India was full of them, Australians and Brits mainly.
That's a good point. So they all had to go then.
They all had to leave.
It's reminds me a bit of Brexit. What's going to happen then? Maybe we shouldn't get on that.
No, that's actually really kind of, that's really different because... these were all one type of people. These were all hippies.
Like-minded folks.
And they had all had lovely, quiet lives. They'd gone to live in India for the purpose of getting away from all the stuff that went on in other countries.
Yeah.
And we were one of these. We were suddenly confronted with the fact of having to go back to Margaret Thatcher's Britain. Mm. Ugh. You know, that makes me feel sick to think about it. And when we went back to Delhi, and we were leaving, and the place was just full of really sad people. Mm. Who had to leave their lovely lives and go back to nothing.
Wow. Yeah. God, that's, I never thought of that. That's a totally fair point.
It's different to any kind of situation that might happen about Britain leaving the EU, because this was one particular group of people who had been there for a specific reason and made their lives in vast variety of different ways that you can't do in your own country.
Right. And then they're getting kicked out, and then they have to go back to this industrialized world.
Yeah.
Probably no job skills to get by in that world.
No. You can exist, you know, reading tarot cards on the beach in Goa and make enough money to live and be happy with it. But you can't do that in Britain.
Right, if that's your job skill. Wow. Maybe nowadays you could become a yoga instructor or something, but, you know, in both societies. But
maybe.
Maybe not back then. Hmm. So that was a sad time for you, huh?
It was. It was really sad. And we didn't have anything to go back to, necessarily. But we ended up living in the southwest of Scotland again and having a business and running a cafe.
Okay.
And then one day, I looked out the door on February and I just thought, oh, fuck this for a carry-on, I'm not doing this.
Yeah, so what was next?
We went to live in Malta.
Oh, in the Mediterranean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bizarre little place, yeah.
Is that the island that's two different countries, or has the...
No, that's Cyprus.
Oh, has a breakaway? Okay.
No, Malta is... it's a little island between Sicily and Libya, in the middle of the Mediterranean. Yeah. And it was a British colony until the 1970s, because if you look on a map, or if you look at history, Malta has been a strategic thing in the Mediterranean, because it's this tiny little island with this huge lagoon that you can literally hide a fleet in it.
Wow.
And the entrance to this lagoon is the width of one ship.
Oh, wow.
So the Napoleon was there. He kept his army and his fleet there, and the British Empire was their main point in the middle of the Mediterranean. The Germans besieged the whole island. It was quite horrific what happened to Malta in the Second World War. But it's a really, actually, to be perfectly honest, it's a really interesting place to go for a holiday. It's a boring as shit place to live.
Okay.
Huh. It's about 40 kilometers long by about 20 kilometers wide. Yeah. And it's got the highest density of population in Europe. It's really, it is kind of interesting. And they've got this weird language.
Oh,
You see a word in Maltese. They use a Roman script, but I think linguistically it's kind of connected to a Semitic language. It's in the same tree as Hebrew, although they don't use that script. But you might see a word that's written like, I don't know, WXYYPHW.
No vowels.
How do you say that?
Yeah.
Well, it was a cool enough place to live for a while. You know, my kids learned how to swim.
Well, there you go. But a bit boring, you think, or
really, really boring, yeah. And after a while, we were illegal aliens there because Malta wasn't in the EU, and it was just like, this is really too much hassle.
Another hassle. So you moved on.
We didn't. I left my partner.
This is the end, huh?
Of that relationship, yeah.
Yeah.
I left my partner on the island, and me and the children and the kids went back to Britain.
Wow.
For a while.
Until.
Actually, that was kind of interesting because, you know, when we were talking about military families earlier, one of the things I've met children who grew up in a military kind of situation, they don't have a sense of identity.
Yeah. No home.
Well, home is not about home. It's about a place that you can identify with culturally. Like, I come from Newcastle. That's my cultural background. I'm a Geordie. It doesn't matter where I live.
Yeah, you'll always be a
Geordie. That's what I am.
Yeah.
And my kids, their father was Scottish. That's his background. He knows where his cultural heritage is. Mm-hmm. And my kids actually didn't, you know. They didn't actually have a dialect. They didn't have an accent. Mm. They spoke this just sort of straight English, which obviously was good for their diction, but not good for their identity. So when I left Malta, I had to make a decision. Shall I go back to live in the southwest of Scotland, in this comfortable hippie kind of community, where I pretty much know what's going to happen? Or shall I go and live in Newcastle again, where I haven't lived for a long time, and I don't know what's going to happen? So I went back to Newcastle.
Oh, okay. And part of that was to give your kids the sense of home or identity?
Well, either one of those places, they were going to get a sense of identity.
Oh, okay.
Because they had a cultural connection with both of them.
Yeah.
With Scotland or with Newcastle. And I know, I guess the choice was based on, I don't know what's going to happen.
Hmm.
So I did that.
Oh,
and then
you like that?
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah. Because going back to Scotland would have been going back.
Yeah, that's tough. It's tough to go back.
It is.
To your old life.
Yeah, and yeah, that wasn't really, I knew what was going to happen. I could see, I knew kind of what would happen if I went to live in Galloway.
Okay.
Which would have been nice and step back into a load of friends, but I went back to Newcastle and I ended up going back to university.
Oh, yeah.
And had 4 or 5 years of being a student, which was great. Mm. And my kids became Geordies.
Okay.
And
they changed their accent?
My daughter did it just naturally. She was 7, I think, at the time. My son was 5, and I think boy schoolyard pressure was a bit difficult for him. He went through, it was painful to listen to him for 3 months when he tried to be a Geordie, tried to pick up the accent. Because obviously on this podcast, I'm coming over as speaking differently to you, but this is not the way I normally speak. This is not Geordie.
Well, I appreciate you speaking in a way that I can understand.
Well, we have a big vocabulary, you know, and we kind of speak a bit faster and things in a different sort of way, so a much different intonation in the voice.
Mm.
But yeah, both my kids are proper Geordies now.
Oh, they are. Okay.
So they ended up with a very good sense of identity, cultural.
Now, are they travelers today, or are they kind of homebodies?
Well, my daughter is at this moment living in Bulgaria. She has been an engineer. She gave it up and she's been a farmer for a while. She's kind of going back to engineering. She does travel. My son is a chef and he has just produced my first grandchild about six weeks ago.
Congratulations.
Thank you. So my son isn't actually a traveler. He's got a happy life with his wife and in Newcastle, although he does have a house in our village in Bulgaria. But one thing about both of my kids is I thought about it yesterday when you were talking. I listened to your podcast with Liam about just what he was saying about the openness about speaking to people and accepting people. And I think my kids both grew up in a world where they accept strangers.
Yeah, that's good.
And find it easy to relate to people. And are much more willing to accept other people and their situations. So they might not actually be travellers, and my son isn't, but he would be a traveller in his heart in many ways.
Yeah, okay.
I think there's a lot of prejudices that young people end up absorbing by never going anywhere.
Yeah. You're right, if you never travel, the world can seem like this big, scary place.
Yeah.
And
it's full of scary people who are different.
Who are different than you. And the truth is, like, a lot of people are very different than you.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Very different. And but we all have a lot of similarities. And I think everyone's the same in probably more ways than they're different, I would even say. We're all human.
Yeah, and I think it's about being interested in those differences.
Right, embrace them, and yeah.
My new grandson, Mason, who's six weeks old, I probably won't see him for a while, and I won't see him very much in his early years, but both my son and his wife promised that when he's old enough, which is a contentious number, then I'm allowed to take him on dangerous holidays.
Oh, okay, cool.
So yeah. I don't know what that'll be. And I think kind of five's old enough really to do, you know.
Yeah.
Might not necessarily be dangerous, but different.
Go somewhere and open his eyes to the world. Yeah, that's a cool thing.
Go on a long train journey. I love train journeys.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
I think it comes from, it's genetic with me, because my grandfather was a train driver. Oh. No, I lie. He was a fireman on a steam train.
Oh, really? Like before they had cars, or?
No, not before they had cars, but before they had diesel trains, steam trains. You know, where you have to shovel the coal in.
Yeah, yeah.
So the main north east coast line in England, from London to Edinburgh, there were two trains. It was called the Flying Scotsman and the Mallard. Mm. And the Mallard had the record for the fastest steam train.
Huh.
They're both really, really famous trains, and my grandfather was the fireman on both of those trains.
So I'm a little confused still. Is he the fireman just to put out fires on the train, or did they drive?
No, he keeps the fire going.
Oh, that's what you mean by fireman. Keep it going. Shovel the coal in.
Yeah, shovel the coal in all day long. He's behind the engine is this huge wagon full of coal.
Yeah, yeah.
And his job is to shovel this coal all day long from that into the engine.
Wow.
And he would, when I was little, he would come home and he was black. but he had a cap on, you know. Yeah. He would wear this cap all day, and then he'd take his cap off, and the complete top of his head was white, and the whole rest of his face was black off the coal dust.
Wow. Huh.
So I think that's where it comes from.
That got you interested in trains?
And India. India, at the time that I lived there, was the best place ever for trains.
Might still be.
No.
No.
They have a network. I mean, one thing that the British left in India was, they left a few things, actually. They left a common language.
Yep.
Which English is the language of bureaucracy and transport and train and everything, and government. And they left a train service, a network, a train network around the whole country.
Yeah.
With amazing stations.
Mm. Yeah. I just got a little taste of that when I was there. You know what? I only went on a train once in India, but it was from Delhi all the way down to Madras.
Right.
Yeah, just because my flight was out of there, but it was it was a good journey.
Well, if you go to Shimla, you have to go on one of the most interesting narrow gauge railways. Hmm. You take the train from Delhi to I forgot what it's called now. It starts with a K, and you get off the main gauge railway and. Kalka, you go to Kalka.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get on the narrow gauge railway that goes up to Shimla, and it goes through about 185 tunnels.
Wow.
And it goes clip, clip, clip all the way up the mountainsides like that.
Yeah, because they can't make quick turns. So,
No, it's just an amazing train journey.
Yeah.
And
it stops
at places. And I remember it stopped one day, and I asked for, leaned out the window, and the guy said, "Would you like some tea?"
Yeah.
Jai Mem Sahib. And I said, I like being called Mem Sahib then. And so I said, So a couple of minutes later, he came back with a tray with a Bon China tea set on it, teapot, cup, milk, sugar cubes, everything.
Uh-huh.
And he just handed me this in the window, and I sat and drank my tea and everything, and then gave it back to him.
Wow.
So, there's a lot of... I don't know whether that's still there.
Huh.
I'm glad I saw all those things in India at the time.
I'll have to look into it. Huh. But I was pleasantly surprised, like 6 months ago in India, that smartphone culture hasn't really developed there yet.
That's good.
I think a couple years from now probably will. But you know, there's not people like looking down at their phones while they're walking down the road, and there a lot of folks have cell phones now, but they're not quite smartphones. They're like these really cheap versions.
Okay.
So it's not quite that quote-unquote developed yet. Whereas China, everybody's got a cell phone, a smartphone. And Yeah.
If you go back to India, you should go out of the towns and cities and take some train journeys to interesting little places.
Yeah, I love the journey because, you know, some people might think, well, why don't you just fly there? It's so much faster.
Oh, no, that's like really bad.
Yeah, it's not even travel for me. It's just...
If you haven't been to a place, why would you fly over it?
Yeah, right.
It's and in India, you meet people in a very, very different way. You know, so I was saying to you earlier, traveling with children opens doors that you just wouldn't have otherwise. And traveling on trains in India with two kids, it was quite amazing. I remember one day we were running to get this train and we bundled, pushed the kids through the window and finally just got on this train and I can't remember where we were, in the middle of Rajasthan or something. And we were both, Davy and I were both, oh, we made it. Yeah. And we sat down, and it was a little carriage, and there was me and him sitting opposite each other, and my daughter sitting next to me. I had hold of my son on my knee, and there was about four or five Indian, best part of a family sitting next to us. Mm. All Indian families travel with about 60 pieces of luggage, and about 40 of those pieces of luggage relate to food.
Interesting.
So me and Davy sat down and were like breathing a sigh of relief and looking out the window. And then I turned around and there's my daughter involved in a meal with these people. They had just opened their things and just included her in it. Yeah. She was like three or something. And she just happily sat there and she was talking away to them and they were talking away to her. And I just said, what happened there? Yeah. So, and then they kind of re-looked at me, then they got us, they led us in the family as well, but they were more interested in her.
Oh, sure, yeah.
But, yeah, having, traveling with small children really, I think, opens doors in an interesting way.
It's cool to hear.
And, you know, I've sadly met a lot of people who say, I'll travel with the children when they're older.
Uh-huh.
And it's like, no, you should do it at the beginning. Hmm. You know, I mean, I don't really think that primary education is that... Formal primary education is not really that important.
Mm. Okay.
If you can... By the end of that, if you can read and write and do all the basic things really well, which anybody can teach you, and you've been travelling around, and you've got a much more open, mature attitude to things and perhaps other language skills...
That's a big one.
That seems to me to be a much more advantageous start to education.
Yeah, it's so cool to hear, like, the kids at the school where my wife works, like the foreign kids speaking Chinese, just you know, playing with the Chinese kids, they speak at the same level, and it's really cool that they're gonna grow up and have this language and not even have an accent.
I remember when we lived in India, my daughter was about, well, she was there actually when she started speaking, because she was about 18 months when we went there, and then so over the next. Over the next year, really, she developed her speech. and sometimes we weren't in, because we lived halfway up this mountainside, we weren't in a lot of daily contact with other people. So she didn't kind of play with lots of kids a lot, except when we went down to the shops and things. But sometimes she would say something to me, and I would say, "What? What are you saying?" And she'd say, "Hindi Pasha, Hindi Pasha." You know, I'm speaking Hindi. It's a Hindi word. You don't know what I'm saying.
Oh.
And I remember when we lived in Malta, my kids went to school in Malta, and they could speak a bit of Maltese.
Oh.
And they it was a great power thing for them that they could
for sure.
They could have a conversation between each other, or they could say things, you know, that I didn't understand.
Yeah, that's the downside of teaching them a new language.
I didn't mind. It was fun.
Hmm. Well, we've been going for... over an hour.
So really?
Yeah, goes by fast. So we should wrap it up.
Okay. Well, that was very nice. It was good to talk about things that I haven't talked about for quite a long while.
It's been great, you know, hearing about these places as they were and a while ago. And
because we talk about like things that are quite a long way back, really. When I think about it, India.
Yeah.
But you know, I don't forget about you. You don't forget about things. I don't think.
Nah. I mean, I haven't yet. I remember my first experiences abroad were in Mexico about 20 years ago, and I still remember all of that just perfectly.
Maybe you were saying this in the podcast that I was listening to yesterday, but correct me if I'm wrong, if it wasn't you that was saying it, but you know, when you're in the same job and the same thing and you're doing the same stuff all the time,
yeah,
everything, the memories blur.
Yeah, it gets compressed.
I don't really find that. I mean, sometimes a sequence I forget. What did I do before that or after that? I'm not really sure. But I can tell you what I was doing when I was in it. You know, and the feelings and stuff that happened in all the different situations. I think that's what travelling does. The memories are much more real and part of the situation.
Right. Yeah, and for anyone listening, if you're kind of thinking, huh, you know, is this just hippy-dippy bullshit? Like, think back to any time you went on vacation, like last year or 10 years ago. Did you go on a trip for 5 days? Even like you just went to a resort. Can you remember that trip pretty well? Probably yes. Can you remember the week before that or the week after? Probably not.
And actually, talking about hippy-dippy stuff, many of the places that people go to now are the places that the hippies discovered in the 70s
sure,
and 80s,
yeah.
without a doubt.
The hippies are up to finding new places now.
Yeah, definitely. Right. Okay.
Well, we'll keep those places a secret. So.
Oh, can I just say one thing that I started? I have been writing some things about my travels.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't talk about Bulgaria, which is where I live now, but one winter when I was hibernating there, I started to write stuff about my life, about the really ridiculous number of houses that I've lived in, about 53 or something to date.
God, that's a lot.
But those kind of things, that was very useful to write things down, but then from that I ended up writing stories about my travels, which are now on a website called Travels With My Life. No, that's not true. Travels Through My Life.
TravelsThroughMyLife.com.
Yeah. Okay. So you could put the link if anybody wants to read anything about what it's like to have a baby in India, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, and I'll maybe link up to that specific story so they can see it. And I mentioned the photo before that I should...
The mummified cat.
The mummified cat, that's where we started. Oh, and that's where we should end.
Yes.
Thanks for coming on the show, Kathy.
All
right. It's been awesome.
Thanks, Dan. Nice to talk to you. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. For more information, you can visit my website, 1000daysbetween.com. That's the number 1000daysbetween.com. From there, you can sign up to get updates from this podcast delivered directly to your inbox. Remember, the Around the World podcast is all about meeting ordinary people who have done extraordinary things. Thanks for listening.